Hello and welcome everybody to the RISE podcast. Our mission is to give you the opportunity to discover the benefits of personal development and help you to use these in a way that empowers you to improve your life. I'm Basil and I welcome you to today's episode that we recorded during our first personal development day here at Menlo College. Ready? Here we go. I saw that our first speaker already joined us. I'm beyond excited to introduce him for today. Jeff Goins, he's a writer, speaker, and entrepreneur. He's the best-selling author of 5 books, including The Art of Work and Real Artists Don't Starve. And his award-winning blog, goinswriter.com, is visited by millions of people every year. And his work has been featured in The Washington Post, USA Today, Entrepreneur, Forbes, Psychology Today, Business Insider, The Huffington Post, Time, and hundreds of other publications. Through his online courses, events, and coaching programs, he helps thousands of creatives succeed every year. Welcome to the virtual stage, Jeff Goins.
Hello. So good to be here. Thank you for having me. Thank you. Thank you, Basil. It's weird to be speaking at a phone right now, but I'm happy to be with you, and I will pretend that you all laugh at my jokes and applaud a lot at the end. I just want to jump in here. I'd love to answer any questions that we have at the end, but Basil gave me clear instructions on timing and whatnot. So I think we'll just jump in here. Honored to be a part of this personal development day at Menlo College. Speaking at a college reminds me of being back in college. I went to school in the cornfields of Illinois, just a few hours southwest of Chicago. And I went to a liberal arts school. And I remember I studied Spanish and religion. And I remember my senior year of college last semester, I decided, you know what, like, I should start working out. Now's a good time to get into shape now that I'm about to go out into the real world. And this friend and I started this habit of working out like 3 days a week, which meant that some days we would just go straight to the hot tub and some days we would actually lift weights. I preferred the hot tub days. And one of these days, you know, a few weeks into it, and it was going well. I mean, we would get together at like 6 o'clock in the morning, which is ridiculous, of course. And I was in the locker room changing. And I was coming in and I ran into a professor who was leaving. And I was a language student. I studied Spanish in college. And he was a German professor. And so we kind of knew each other from the language arts programs. And I kind of like bumped into him. And he was totally naked because it was the locker room. And he just struck up a conversation with me as if this were, you know, were the most normal thing in the world. And he was a gruff German professor. And I was a scrawny, self-conscious, you know, at 22-year-old at the time. And we started talking and I'm getting dressed. He's just naked. He's getting ready to go into a shower or something. And he is, hey, you know, what are you doing here? I was like, oh, I'm here to work out. And he goes, oh, that's great. He goes, you come here often? And I was like, this is getting real awkward real fast. And I said, yeah, you know, a few times a week, sort of doing this a few weeks, like a month or two ago with a friend. And he goes, oh, that's great. That's great. And, you know, he's like stretching and stuff. And I'm like, man, like, here's a towel, maybe just like wear the towel. I don't know. And then he said something that blew my mind. He said, you know, the habits that you form here will be with you for the rest of your life. And that hit me. And then he continued to stretch, and he's very hairy German professor. And so I just, you know, I went on my way to the hot tub, but I never forgot that. And I actually thought about that. I thought, oh, well, that's really interesting. And I'm 38 years old now. So for many years ago, that was in college, you know, a decade and a half ago. That seems to be true, which is to say that, you know, the people who love to like go out drinking and partying, which, you know, is totally fine. That could be a part of the college experience. After we graduated, you know, it wasn't like a light switch went on and they decided to change this behavior that they've been practicing for, you know, 4 years. And those who studied a lot and worked really hard, same kind of deal. You know, and what I learned from this experience is college is not a break from the real world. It's not even preparation for the real world. Like sometimes people will tell you, it is the real world. Like it is part of reality, right? This is part of reality called college. And so what I learned from that experience and from every experience is that whatever you're doing now, you're practicing becoming the person that you're going to someday be. And so we're here at a personal development summit. And so, you know, what does that mean to develop yourself, to develop yourself personally? It means that you are practicing becoming someone, and everything that you do is practice for something else. And years ago, I quit my job to become a full-time author. And I had a lot of people who asked me how I did it. Like, how did you do that? How did you replace your income? How did you find your calling, your vocation, your purpose, whatever word you want to use, your life's work? And I didn't really know how to explain it. So I wrote a book about it called The Art of Work. But one of the things that I remembered in this journey of transitioning from, you know, I graduate college, I study Spanish. So then, of course, the next right step is for me to join a band and tour all of North America and Taiwan with a rock band, which is what I did. I don't know why I got a Spanish degree for that, but, you know, that's part of the journey. And then eventually I went and worked for a nonprofit, and I did that for about 7 years. I was the director of marketing for an international relief and development nonprofit. We did some service work all around the world, particularly in the developing world. And I quit that job because I'd started this blog and I'd started writing and publishing books, and I was making enough money to do that full time. And it was still really scary because part of me thought I might fail, I might mess this up. And I had a conversation with a mentor. Just like, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. I'm not sure if this is the right move. You know, what do you think? And he said to me something. He said, Jeff, what's happened to you is rare. What's happened to you is rare. I'm your friend and I didn't see it coming. I don't think anybody saw it coming. You have to consider that this is your calling. This is your life's work. And that if you don't do that, you will be like disobeying this purpose in your life. And that hit me hard. And since then, my understanding of calling, vocation, work, that's all evolved. But I think we've all had moments in our lives where an opportunity opens up and you realize it's not going to be there forever and you need to step into it. And I call that a calling, a moment where you feel drawn in the direction of some deep, sacred purpose, the way in which you're going to spend your life. And what I've learned since then is it doesn't have to be rare. It doesn't have to be rare that a person finds work that they personally find fulfilling. Yeah, years ago, and it doesn't always look the way we think it looks, by the way. Years ago, the Gallup organization did a study of all of the world's workers. It was obviously a sample. They didn't survey everybody, but they did this huge worldwide sample, and they basically asked people questions to see how satisfied people were in their work and their vocation. And 87% of the people who were surveyed said they were either disengaged or actively disengaged in the work that they were doing. So almost 9 out of 10 people were just not having it. They weren't into it. They weren't happy with the work that they were doing. They weren't even engaged. And engaged means like you're involved in it, you're focused on it. There's some sense of passion, purpose, excitement, energy. They were either disengaged or actively disengaged. Actively disengaged means you're like throwing wrenches into the machine, trying to break the thing. Disengaged just means that you're like punching a clock. And I read that, I thought, like, come on, like, we can do better than this. Like, I think I could do a survey of everybody here virtually and in person and go, hey, like, who here wants to spend their life doing something that like barely feels good enough to sustain, right? Like, who here just wants to like go to work every day and punch a clock? Sometimes, you know, when I'm in a retail store or like I'm getting groceries or something, you know, back in the day when I didn't have them delivered, I talk to the clerk. I'm like, how's your day going? Like, oh, it's going okay. You know, this thing happened. We've all experienced people who are not engaged in the work that they were doing. Some of us may have had teachers like that, right? I remember having certain professors in college where I'm like, oh, I don't really have to try that hard. Yeah, it'll be fine. Maybe you guys have better professors. I had a lot of great professors, but you know, every once in a while you meet somebody who's not in it. They're not into it. And that's not fun. And then every once in a while you meet somebody who is so full of life that it's captivating, that it's energizing. I believe that we can all find work that looks and feels like that, that it's not as hard as we think. But here's the thing, it's going to surprise you. And so I embarked on this quest to write a book called The Art of Work, where I interviewed hundreds of people that I thought, that I experienced, like they were living their life's purpose. And some of these people were homemakers, and some of them were park rangers, and some of them were professional authors and entrepreneurs and doulas. And some people made lots of money, some people made a little bit of money, but the point was they were doing something and they were engaged in it, they were excited about it. They were happy and they felt like they'd found it, you know, or part of it. And so I shared some of the things in this book that they had in common. And I want to share a few of those with you. But before I do that, I want to tell you the story of Garrett Rush Miller, who was this boy. He's now a young man that I met. He's about your guys' age. He's like 20. And when I met him, he was a teenager. And he told me his story, which was that at 5 years old, he was going to T-ball practice. And his parents noticed that when he was swinging the bats, something was off. You know, parents are, I'm a father of two kids now. And you can tell when something's off with your kid. If something was off with Garrett, he was kind of wobbly when he was running to the bases. He wasn't balancing right. And so they took him to the doctor. And they did a CT scan, and the CT scan revealed a golf ball sized tumor in his brain, a golf ball sized tumor in a 5-year-old's brain. And the doctor said he's got a few years left to live at most. And in one fateful day, this 5-year-old boy got a death sentence, and his parents started counting down the days that they had left to live with their son. And so they ended up doing some surgery. They removed the brain tumor, but the cancer remained. And the problem with the surgery was that it paralyzed the boy. He couldn't walk. He could barely speak. He could barely move. He was bound to a wheelchair. And his parents realized this is not about him surviving. It's not about him living a long life. It's about us living the fullest life we can right now. And so what happened was the father, Garrett's dad, decided that he was going to do something special with the remaining days that he had with his son. And what he decided to do was run a triathlon with his son, who was in a wheelchair, right? And so he does it at 6 years old, at the 1-year anniversary of that death sentence. Keep in mind, Garrett's still got cancer. He still only has a few years left to live. He and his father crossed the finish line of this triathlon. And it was a way of sort of declaring to themselves and to the cancer and to the world, like, we're not going to let this define us. We're going to find a way to live a great life, even within these confines. And they did it that year when Garrett was 6 years old. And then they did it again the next year and again and again and again. And they kept going. And then they started finding alternative ways to treat the cancer. It went into remission. Garrett eventually became an Eagle Scout. He climbed, he ended up climbing Machu Picchu. He ended up doing all these incredible things, and he started volunteering his free time with Wounded Warriors, which is a nonprofit that works with war veterans. And what I learned from Garrett and his dad, because at any moment they said the cancer could have come back, we decided to live as rich of a life as we possibly could in as little time as possible. I mean, imagine that, you know, imagine at 5 years old, basically being told you're not going to live to see adulthood. And he just packed as much life as he could into it. And I think we would all agree that, like, that was a bad hand. That was a crap hand that Garrett got dealt. you know, getting cancer, getting a brain tumor at 5 years old. And so what I learned from him is what makes a life great is not the chances we get. Like, we don't get to necessarily determine the hands that we're dealt in life, but what we do with them. What makes a life great are not the chances you get, but what you do with them. And I saw that this was a trait in a lot of the people that I met when I was working on this book, and just throughout my life, the people who are living truly great lives have had stuff happen to them, unexpected things, surprises, tragedies, triumphs. Like, we've all had life go a little bit differently than we thought it would, right? And so how do you find your calling, your purpose, this thing that you're meant to do? You have to first begin by listening to your life. In the words of Parker Palmer, who's an author and an activist and also a Quaker, he says that before I can tell my life what I want to do with it, maybe some of you here today are thinking, like, I'm going to set some goals. I'm going to create a life plan. That's all amazing. That's telling your life what you want to do with it. That's great. Do that. But before you do that, according to Parker Palmer, before I can tell my life what I want to do with it, I need to listen to my life telling me who I am. Before you tell your life, here's what I want to do with you, here's what we're going to do, begin by listening to your life, paying attention, looking for what I call sparks of insight, of motivation, of excitement. Are there some things that you naturally enjoy more than others? Are there some things that you're better at than others? Now, hear me on this. I don't think that just because, you know, your dad was a baker and your great grandfather was a baker that you need to be a baker. I'm not saying that even all of the stuff that happened to you defines you. So I don't think your past determines your future, but I do think it should inform it. And so for me, I've always gravitated towards the arts, towards acting, music, writing. And so everything that I've done has had this touch of creativity to it. And so when I began to listen to my life, really those first several years out of college, trying to figure out, what do I want to do? What do I want to commit my life's work to? Lots of people say, well, you just know. Well, I didn't know. And if you know, that's great. But if you don't know, I would encourage you to adopt this habit of beginning to listen to your life. And something very practical that you can do is literally like draw a timeline and think about or even write down some of the most significant moments to you in your life, not to others, but to you. And so for me, that was like sixth grade, won the school spelling bee. Right? It was in college performing this live brawl that we did for an acting class where we literally like beat the crap out of each other in front of everybody. Everybody thought it was a real fight, but it was just this fun stage combat class that we did, but we didn't tell anybody. And there was always this element of like making things and performing. And so some of the most significant experiences in my life are creating something and then sharing it with people. And so I thought, well, that's probably going to be a part of my life's work, of the thing that I do. And so I continued on this process. And when you begin to listen to your life, okay, what are the things that sort of define or give some depth to this character called me? Then you've got to look for opportunities to try things. And I call this painful practice. And what I mean by that, for anyone who's an athlete here, you might understand this. If you're going to get really good at something, you've got to do it almost to the point that it hurts, right? Like, think about any sort of athletic activity. If you want to gain muscle, you want to get better at something, you've got to push it to the point of discomfort. And the same thing is true with your calling, your vocation. Try lots of different things. See and look for sparks. See what sparks in you, because you know that you're onto something when you're doing something that other people hate, that they find grueling, and you love it. Like, I love writing. People are like, oh, I hate writing. I love having written. I don't. I love writing, right? I love just sitting and coming up with ideas and sharing it. Not everybody loves that. So when you find that the things that you love are things that other people can't stand, that's a spark. That's not the thing necessarily, but it's a clue. And part of this process is you're just a detective looking for clues that are going to tell you who you are. Before I can tell my life what I want to do with it, I need to listen to my life telling me who I am. So listen to your life, look for sparks, practice things, try things to the point that it's hard and uncomfortable and even a little bit painful. So that, because if you can do something that part of you hates, it goes, oh, this hurts, you know, And you, and the other part loves it. You go, man, I love this. This is exciting. I love how hard this is. I love what a challenge it is. That's a clue. And then the third thing that I want to share with you today is to let it unfold. Let it unfold, right? So we're going to listen to our lives. We're going to look for sparks. We're going to let it unfold. Lots of loves. And what that means is I have found that your calling is not one thing. It's many things. And it's not about becoming a jack of all trades, but a master of some. I call this a portfolio life. The truth is, you're probably going to have a series of careers, a series of jobs. You might thrive in what's called the gig economy these days. You don't have to pick one thing. Oh my gosh, that's an incredible amount of pressure. But if you have a theme, if you have an idea, this is the story that's unfolding in my life. You can try different things and look for the thread and see how it all fits together. You can think of your work as a series of gigs that make up this portfolio that becomes your life. And the last thing that I want to share, and then we can, you know, maybe do a little bit of Q&A, and I know we're tight on time, is I'm actually sitting at a desk right now. I'm on a retreat out in the, look at all these books that I haven't read, out in the country of Tennessee. And I'm sitting at this like amazing writer desk. And when we get done here, I'm going to begin to work on what will become my next book. And it reminds me of this story about Stephen King, where for years and years, he wrote bestsellers and he was addicted to drugs and alcohol. And he tells a story in his book on writing, which is that there are books that he wrote that millions of people read that he didn't remember writing. And Stephen Covey says that many of us will climb a ladder in life only to realize it was leaning against the wrong wall. And so Stephen King says for years, he wanted this big oak desk because that made him a writer, right? And he gets the desk and he writes and he's miserable. He's succeeding at the thing that he wanted to do, but he's not there for it. He's not in it, right? Maybe you've had this experience where you've succeeded at something that other people think is great and it feels kind of empty for you. And he eventually gets sober. He's got some, you know, intervention from people that he loves, and he gets back into his work, but he changes everything about it. He gets rid of the big desk. He turns his study into a place where his kids can come play. And he's now writing his books in the margins of his life. And he said that I used to think that life was a support system for art or work. Now I realize that it's the other way around. That work is a support system for life. And some of us have kind of been taught and told, and maybe you're even picking this up in college in certain areas where it's like, if you could just find this thing and do this and really be great at it, this would be your life. It would be complete. And the truth is your occupation, right? The thing that occupies your time, your work is a part of your life. And your calling is this whole thing that you're creating, right? It's not a single magnum opus. It's a portfolio of work that you're creating. And remember that it's about the joy that you're getting out of it and also the joy that other people are getting out of it. Frederick Buechner said that our calling is that place where our deepest joy meets the world's deepest need. And Jackie Robinson said that's a life is not significant except for its impact on others. And so how do we find that? We begin by listening, right? Paying attention to the themes that keep popping up in our lives, the things we like, don't like, we're good at, we're not good at. We look for sparks by practicing lots of different things and seeing what do I love that other people don't love? And then finally, we let it unfold into the portfolio that it's becoming and that you're going to spend your whole life creating that. So buckle up and have fun.
Wow, Jeff. Thank you so much. It was interesting because every time you explained something, I like had a question coming up in my mind and then you answered it. And
it's like, oh, okay.
We have a question coming in right now. Okay. I'm just going to read it to you. One person is asking, in those uncertain times, you might feel that even the things that you once find exciting become uninteresting. What do you do when your motivation is fading?
Yeah, I think that's great. I think that's another clue. Like that's another piece of data. It's okay to think I found it and then realize it's a piece of the puzzle. So what do you do? One, it's okay to take a break. I have a friend who's an amazing professional piano player and he's amazing, like Ben Folds, you know, level great. And he got burnt out as a teenager, right? And so he gave it up. And he's an incredible piano player. He'd been playing since he was like 3 years old. And his parents were like, okay, that's fine, you know? And then in college, he picked it back up and he fell back in love with it. Like, it's okay to like break up with your passion for a little while and try something else. I have found that when you let that go and it stays gone, then it wasn't meant for you. But if you let it go and you miss it, the passion comes back and you try different things in the meantime, when you bring it back, there's some more kind of texture to it, right? Robert Greene says in his book that the future belongs to people who take different things and combine them in interesting ways. So one of the ways to think about what is my passion, what is my vocation, maybe take like one or two or three things that you love doing and find a unique way to combine them. That's going to set you apart from the competition and from other people. And it just makes it a little bit more interesting. And so one of the ways that we find those different pieces and ways to texture the vocation, if you will, is to let go of the thing that you think it is because you're burnt out and try something new. And maybe the new thing is it, or maybe you find ways to combine these things.
So let's say you find your passion and you notice something I'm interested in, maybe it's like a sports or writing or anything. How can you give any advice on how you can make it your profession? Like that you can actually live from it like you're doing?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the first thing that you have to do is you've got to find somebody who's already doing it, right? And you've got to study them and apprentice under them in some way. Now, apprenticeship is not a thing that we're used to these days. Like there are very few vocations where you can go do a formal apprenticeship like you used to be able to do in like the Middle Ages. But there are these things that I call accidental apprenticeships where you can study somebody from afar. Maybe like when I wanted to become an author, what I did was I read a bunch of books and found authors who were doing the work that I wanted to do. And I just studied them. I watched them, like, how are they making money? What are they doing? What does it look like? And I was able to actually interview some of these people who were my heroes and get some clues on how this works. And at a high level, I would say, find somebody who's done it, find a way to learn what they did and how they did it, because it's not just like go back to school and study this thing. Sometimes it's that, you know, doctor, lawyer, there's kind of these like standard paths to doing it. If you want to become an entrepreneur, an author, an artist, a graphic designer, professional musician, whatever, I mean, you know, start a bakery, you know, like typically you have to find somebody who's done it and then study them and a handful of other people and see like, what are the things that all these people have in common, and then how can I do that? And for me, I mean, business 101 is you've got to have something to sell. You've got to have some unique service or product that you want to offer the world. As a writer, I think of things, tell stories, and create them. Two, you have to find an audience that needs that thing. And then three, you've got to find a way to get them to buy what you have to offer. So how do you make a living off of your passion? You don't. You start by going, I've got this thing that I think I could do that maybe some people would pay me money for. Now, how do I find one person to pay me money? So for me, I went, okay, I'm going to write a little short book and self-publish it and see if anybody will buy it. And if I get one person to buy it, I've proved the concept. You know, I'm now an entrepreneur. I've started a business. You go from zero to one, you've got a business. But until you sell your first widget, until you get your first customer, it's just an idea. And so don't try to make a living off of it. Try to get one person to pay you money for this and then find somebody else like them and somebody else and somebody else and somebody else. And that's how you turn it into a career.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thanks, everybody. If you have any questions that I didn't answer, you can hit me up on Instagram at Jeff Goines. And then Basil has all my info. Feel free to share it. But thank you. I was honored to be a part of it.
Thanks everybody for tuning in for today's episode with Jeff Goines. If you want to get more content from Rise, check out our Instagram at Rise Club Menlo. Thanks again for listening, and we're looking forward to seeing you next time.